Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is an episode that's going to cover a few things because the Rotterdam Film Festival has happened, but also other less fun stuff. And I'm very happy to be doing this episode with Jordan Kronk.
Hey, Nick, how are you? Thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you back. I forget, did we talk at Locarno or not this year? Because you were...
Yeah, not this year. Oh, Venice, I think.
Venice, that's what it is. Yes, right. Yeah, it was inaugural Venice. So we both had our minds blown by agro drift, as I would
say. Exactly. Still recovering. Now you can watch it at a strip club in LA.
Oh, yeah. They're trying unconventional venues. Or when do you know?
Self-distribution. Yeah, because it never got picked up. So I guess he's self-distributing it and starting at like some strip club in LA. It costs $100. I don't know what this includes exactly, but
oh wow,
I'm looking for an assignment if anyone's interested though.
Yeah, definitely. I like the $100 gambit. It's like, yeah, if we can just sell 20 of them.
Exactly.
So we'll be talking about the Rotterdam Film Festival, which I'm going to be relying on you to update me on, since I couldn't go this year, since I was at Sundance and then coping with having been at Sundance. But what we will start out with actually is not any films at all, but what's sort of a big event, basically, for, I mean, anyone who loves movies, really, and not like a happy one either. And that's CinemaScope, the news about CinemaScope, which is no longer news by now, but...
Yeah. Well, yes. CinemaScope has ceased publication after 97 issues. It's a magazine started in Toronto by Mark Berenson in 1999. So this is the 25th, or would have been the 25th anniversary. So yeah, I don't know. It's been kind of a bummer to see the news break. I mean, Mark's been kind of hinting at this, I think, in his, if you read his editor's notes, for quite a while. I mean, years ago, there was like doom and gloom about it not continuing. But that's why it kind of was a little surprising still, because you never really thought he'd go through with it. So it was sad to hear. And then once it became kind of more real, like this was a real possibility, you know, before, you know, assignments went out for the last issue, it was kind of clear that this was going to be it. So, you know, I think he stacked the lineup with a lot of good contributors and pieces to like end on. So this is the 97th issue just came out. And yeah, I was hoping at the very least he would take it to 100 issues, but I guess it wasn't financially feasible anymore. He said that he could potentially do something online. But he doesn't know what that would look like. I don't know how much like interest there is to keep it going in that manner, or how much money could be generated in that way to make it even a possibility. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure. For the time being, it's just done completely, I guess. You know, just the latest loss in a long line of like publications going down. But this is a very, I mean, specifically for me, I should note that like I have no part in the magazine other than as a contributor for the last 11 years or so.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah, played a big role in my life. Most things in my professional life probably would go back to getting the gig with them many years ago. So I'm super grateful for the opportunity and the writing for them every few months for the last decade or more. So, but yeah, I think it's just kind of a bummer as far as Mark mentioned in his editor's note, like losing a publication that covers like a pretty specific kind of art cinema festival film, you know, just a certain kind of movie that could fall through the cracks otherwise and might going forward.
Yeah. And also just, I mean, a magazine that cultivated a community around these films. So like, you know, some of the movies they write about, other places write about, or maybe more than they might have before.
Yeah.
So I think that's something also that's, and just, yeah, really being really faithful to film as art. There was no issue where I felt like, oh, this is kind of compromising. It was kind of just sort of uncompromising in the best way.
Yes.
Because I was just looking online, you can kind of go through the issue archive and just look at past issues. And it doesn't go back online, as far as I can tell, past issue 50, but that's like 2012.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just sort of this greatest hits of, if you go back and think like, what are like really significant movies in terms of just, again, like film art, you know, and you got like Holy Motors, you got Leviathan on the cover, you've got Act of Killing, you know, you've got Denis Coté. I mean, it is a Canadian magazine as well.
Yes. Yes, lots of Canadian content.
Yeah. I was always sort of defensive about it when people would talk about it as like too niche in some way, or like too festival, too inside baseball, because it's like, I don't know, not really. If you look at the kind of movies that have been championed and the filmmakers that have been championed and how they eventually trickle down and then people are more widely embrace them. Or maybe they don't and they but you still need the support.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a magazine, and the only one that I know of that is like, well, I guess beholden to nothing, but like it follows the festival circuit. You know, when the movies in general that are covered and on the cover are not films that are coming out anytime soon. This issue has like three or four pieces about movies that haven't even premiered yet. You know, and it's definitely plugged into like the festival circuit, and obviously with Mark working on the festival circuit and many of the contributors also doing that, it has that kind of a sensibility.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's always focused on a certain kind of art cinema, you know, going back to even the 2000s, like some of the films. I mean, in that way, I think it is one of the most, if not the most influential, like magazine of the 21st century, just as far as like art cinema goes. Like if a certain movie is championed or covered extensively, like I think it did point people or indicate something about that film that it would be important going forward, even for a small community of people, but at least it would be something important to like keep an eye on.
Oh, definitely. And also just, I think, having the freedom to pick things that are higher, middle, or lower profile, you know, in terms of, yeah, if it is niche, it wouldn't stop that from being on the cover, you know? So again, I'm just sort of flipping through and like from one issue to the next, you might have, you know, a Paul Verhoeven movie on the cover. And then the next issue, you know, you'll have Roberto Minervini. And yeah, that also speaks to championing all manner, all spectrum of, you know, hybrid cinemas. Also to a pool of writers that, you know, it had its own stable of writers, yourself included, was also very distinctive, is very distinctive. I hate to say was even. I don't even want to quite say that.
I know. Well, that's one of the things too that I'm gonna miss about it. You know, for better or worse, there's critiques to be made maybe about the contributor pool and the makeup of that on occasion. But I think in keeping it so tight for the most part over the years has it cultivated a like a very specific voice, which I don't think many, if any, publication really has nowadays. Where you can, it may be more of a thing of the past where you could just be like, you know, that magazine, like that movie or whatever. Whereas now I don't think you can do that as much, but you were always able to be like, well, CinemaScope liked that movie, regardless of who really wrote the piece. And I don't know if you would do that really with a lot of publications nowadays, just because it's much more, many more contributors. It's less like focused on a certain pool of contributors or sensibility. So that's one thing I think it's going to die along with it as well, which is unfortunate. You know, I'm hoping that they can do something in the future as far as anthologizing it in some way or getting the content out there. Because like you said, the content from the first decade, most of it is not on there. So I think there's a couple pieces that they put on like from the late 2000s, but by and large, the pieces really aren't on there from that first decade or more.
And yeah, I totally agree with how it has a voice, which is rare and rare, just I guess partly because a lot of publications maybe feel, and I'm sure people are going to be angry at me at this for this, but they feel a necessity to weigh in on all the stuff coming through. I mean, but at the same time, CinemaScope does cover a ton of movies each issue. But yeah, covering everything is going to make it hard to have a particular voice shine through if you're not winnowing things down necessarily.
It was like an advocacy magazine, you know, just,
Yeah.
you know, the things people wrote about is because they wanted to. Like, I was never asked to write anything. It was all, what do you want to write about? And so, in general, the pieces are positive. But when there are like some pretty epic negative reviews of stuff, it's like really great because people are really invested in their thoughts and opinions on certain filmmakers. And of course, it was known as, other than the real like laudatory features and profiles and things like that, there was, you know, Mark's canned pieces, which were like legendarily like grumpy about the films from Cannes, and like so it had a certain edge to it that also you don't see in many places, just because maybe can't do that at places that aren't completely like independently published by like a single person. So
Yeah, I think that is kind of true, and that's why having an independent magazine is all the more important because, yeah, a lot of other places, you know, I mean, for one thing, a number of publications are owned by one place, you know, and you know, I think you have like two film trade magazines and Art Forum and IndieWire, all owned by Penske Media. And I also just want to say this might be something that's not always apparent because the way things come out in a flood about particular movies when they come out, maybe you can appreciate this too. But CinemaScope, I mean, like you said, they're writing about movies before they even come out. They are like not taking cues from anyone. And that's something that can be hard to appreciate, I think. I don't know. I just want to single that out. There's really something to taking stands on movies before really anyone else has seen them or said anything about them.
Yeah, it can be a little nerve-wracking at times. There are movies, yeah, I wrote about many times that like had no, there was just no reviews because they were like about to premiere. Or I was, oftentimes it would be like, you know, it's a good a premiere at the next festival I'm going to. So I would do the an interview or a piece on the film before the festival. And then when it came out, then the reviews had already been coming out for a few weeks. But like I had probably done the piece before had read anything. So sometimes it was a little nerve-wracking or anxiety-inducing just to like know that you're either going to be the first opinion or like in some ways people might take cues from thoughts on the film. So, but in that way, yeah, it kept things sort of in a certain way, kind of pure or just like exciting to read, like
yeah,
first reactions sort of to films.
And not like fast takes either. They're pretty like,
oh, exactly. Yeah. These are extremely long. That's another thing, like just like long form criticism. Like very rarely was there ever like a word count or like, you know, and if there are, you know, there are thousands and thousands of words. So it's pretty free. And there was no like style that was implemented or like discussed ever that I know about. It was just kind of people who read the magazine and kind of have a similar ideas about cinema or sensibility. And you know, that's how I got linked up with it. You know, I read it for years and then decided to try and write for them, you know, so I was predisposed to kind of be interested in this kind of filmmaking. But yeah, that's kind of how the pool of contributors, I think, kind of developed over the years.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to sound like I'm like writing a eulogy or something.
Yeah.
I never give up hope.
I want to say one, for people interested, there is a good, if you're a Twitter user or X or whatever, if you go on, there's a Toronto cinephile named David Davidson is doing like an ongoing thread of like, he has like most of the magazines going back to the beginning. And he's been posting for the last like week or so, a quasi history of the magazine, just like in his view, taking pictures of features in the magazine and just like charting the evolution of its voice and the contributors and when certain initiatives were implemented and things like that. So it's kind of cool little history that's ongoing and is only like a quarter of the way through the history of the magazine. So I think it's worth checking out if you're interested in seeing. There's also stuff on there I've never seen, just like images from like issue number 5 or something, which I don't have. So
that sounds really cool.
Yeah. And you can see like, I mean, from the beginning, you have like people like James Quant and Rosenbaum and, you know, Dennis Lim and excellent people writing from the very beginning. So yeah, it's cool to kind of see some of these things that are not available and that would hopefully will one day be collected in some manner.
That's neat. I didn't notice that. I mean, I did see that the CinemaScope account has been posting the various autographed signed issues.
Oh yes, he's been posting all the autographed issues. Yeah.
Which are,
so that's kind of cool to see like a little history of the magazine through that too.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the comments are pretty random.
Yeah. There's also, if people are interested in this, I did an interview with Mark actually for a video series I did for about a year during the pandemic. I did one with Mark and it was like a turned into like a 2-hour talk about the magazine mostly. So if people are interested in that, they can find it on my Twitter, on my Patreon. So it was something I had locked behind a paywall, but I opened it up for people to watch if they want. So he doesn't do a ton of talking about the magazine. So it's kind of interesting to hear firsthand.
Yeah, people should listen to that as well. Sorry, I'm just looking at one of these issues. Harmony Korine, probably not the most.
Oh, the Trash Humpers one? Yeah, that's a great yeah. Cover. 10 years of trash humping is a good cover title.
Also, just I want to thank everyone who worked on it and helped out with editing it in all the other ways too. So
yeah, I mean, it's a who's who of like, you know, Adam Naiman and Andrew Tracy, and so many people went through there editorially and just like as a critic.
Yeah, that's the bad news, but but I guess we'll talk about some of the movies that are, you know, movies that might appear in, and for all I know, I mean, I haven't looked at the new issue, so maybe a couple of these are even in there, I don't know. But yeah, movies at Rotterdam.
Well, this is the second year that we're kind of back into in-person activities after 2 years online during the pandemic. So it was cool to be back again. Last year felt a little, I don't know, on the ground, it didn't feel tentative. There was a lot of people, but like programming wise, it was a little more scattershot than it had been. Even during the pandemic, I thought there was a couple of strong additions with some significant films. But yeah, last year was a little bit of a wash, at least for me. So I'm happy to report that this year had many more films that I enjoyed. And I think a couple that will actually travel and people will be able to see eventually, because a lot of times, especially Rotterdam, some of the films like will be talked about a little bit in certain circles, but never really travel to other, you know, the US or even get distribution. So yeah, it's kind of nice to see that in this time.
Yeah. And I guess Rotterdam titles, I mean, in terms of where they end up trickling down, some of them will end up in New Directors Do Films.
Yeah.
I mean, not a whole lot.
Yeah. I mean, there's like certain films of recent years, like The Planes ended up traveling a lot. You know, the Year of the Discovery, I think, was in New York Film Festival. So like certain films have been, here and there break through to bigger festivals in North America, but they program a lot of stuff, and it's a lot of like really niche type cinema, so a lot of it does not ever travel. So that's one incentive for me to keep going, and it's one reason I have never been to Sundance, is because just there's more allure, at least for me, writing or discovering films that are probably not gonna have a chance to see otherwise.
Right.
That's always been why I go. Everyone always asks why I don't go to Sundance, and that's because they overlap is the main thing, and they one has a certain kind of filmmaking that I kind of gravitate toward.
So this year, what was like a first film that jumps to mind as a highlight for you?
Well, a highlight, and also I think a film that people might at least be aware of the filmmakers, is a movie called Dream Team by Lev Kalman and Whitney Horn, who whose most well-known film is called L for Leisure. They also made another film after that called Two Planes and a Fancy. So this is their third feature. And if you've seen those movies, you might be at least a little prepared for what this one might be stylistically. It's another kind of hallucinatory exercise in style, I guess. This is a film set mostly in Mexico, but also kind of hops around to Vancouver and also Spain. But it follows two Interpol agents played by Esther Guerrero and Alex Hung Tae, the musician from Dirty Beaches, who performs as Dirty Beaches. So they are on an assignment to investigate the death of a coral smuggler in Mexico. And what they uncover as they go to Mexico is like this vast conspiracy involving coral, and this international coral conspiracy where it's killing a lot of people in the science community and in the government. And it has this kind of like real, I don't know, ambitious setup, but it's very modest as far as, it's aesthetic, like their other films, just kind of young, good-looking people hanging out, talking in kind of mannered dialogue, shot in 16 millimeter, and thing, lots of sunsets and neon and electronic music on the soundtrack. It has some kind of like climate and environmental concerns as well, which are certainly there, and I think an important aspect of it. But in general, with their films, there's kind of just like a vibe to them that is really easy to be taken with. So yeah, it is one of my favorites. I'm sure you've seen their other work, so I don't know if.
I've seen Elf Leisure and Two Planes and a Fancy. Been a bit. So yeah, I was curious about this one, and then I was stupidly too late in realizing I actually could have viewed it online. It was one of the movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I could have like bought a little whatever e-ticket. But one thing I was curious about, I mean, could you talk a bit about the kind of approach to genre in?
Oh, yeah, this is a, I didn't mention, but an homage or a film made in the style of 90s basic cable TV thrillers. So,
Okay.
yeah, they cite La Femme Nikita, which, if you're my age, it was like a sexy show from the late 90s.
Sure.
It was a show that was always on like at 10 p.m. after after dark, one of those kind of quasi-erotic thriller TV shows. But anyway, it's supposed to be made in that vein, and it is separated in episodes, actually. So I think there are 7 episodes that each have their own credit sequence. So it kind of like restarts every 10, 15 minutes.
It really sort of looks like you're binging a show or something.
That's the idea. I mean, the story continues, so I guess you could get rid of those sequences and it would just flow normally, but it just has kind of like a unique credit sequence for each part with its own title. So new characters are introduced in each part, so it does have its own kind of like generative logic to it. Yeah, it is supposed to like, I guess, be like watching a TV show. Although it's more like webisodes since they're very short.
Right.
Otherwise, it's very like hypnotic and transportive, and the two agents kind of, everything's very sexualized in it too. Like there's all this dialogue that's, quasi either erotic or suggestive in nature. So lots of innuendos and things like that going on. And if you've seen their other films, it's like cast full of like young, extremely good-looking people doing cool things.
Well, I feel like that might be one that we'll see. I say that based on nothing, but feels like it.
No, yeah, it'll have a New York screening, I'm sure, at some point. There's a lot of people associated with their filmmaking that from that area and stuff, so I'm sure it'll come around soon enough.
So that's a Dream Team from Lev Kalman and Whitney Horn. And which one do you want to talk about next?
Let's see. There's a film called Under a Blue Sun that I like. It's a kind of an essay film. It's made by a guy named Daniel Mann, who is Israeli but lives in London, I think, kind of in the academic and art world a little bit. But this film is very fascinating, actually. It takes as its like starting point, Rambo 3, the 1988 Sylvester Stallone film, as kind of a vehicle to look at image making and how images are used by the media as propaganda and things of that nature, because Rambo 3 is set in Afghanistan. Well, I should mention I've never actually seen Rambo 3, but as I understand it,
Yeah, I was trying to remember if I had seen it.
I only fuck with First Blood, but I have not got to 3 yet. But I guess the plot is he's like assisting the Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviets. But it's set in Afghanistan, but it was actually shot in the Israeli desert, in the Negev desert. So there is all this really interesting footage, like archival footage, behind the scenes footage of the making of Rambo 3. So there's, interviews with Stallone and whatnot, and then on the ground footage of them in Israel shooting the film. And that's kind of contrasted with new footage that man shot in Israel of the same locations nowadays, and also interviews with many of the like Bedouin locals who either remember the film or worked on the film. One in particular is a Palestinian Bedouin local who worked in the art department on the film and like still has all these props for it and like all this like memorabilia associated with it. So he's kind of like one of the recurring characters in the film. So it contrasts these two things. And there's also voiceover narration by the director who reads from these letters that he wrote to Stallone about the film, unanswered letters to
Yeah, I
Stallone.
was going to ask if he got a reply.
Yeah, they're just kind of like these reflexive little writings where he kind of just implores Stallone to like reflect on what the experience was like and the implications of the experience. Yeah, it's a pretty fascinating movie. It has a lot of fun things in it because it's, this funny footage of the original Rambo 3, and there's also kind of humorous footage of Stallone behind the scenes. But it opens up into this kind of investigation of colonialism, and it's a very timely movie too because it deals with, the Palestinian population of Israel as well. It was very entertaining. I think like an audience would get into it, even though it is kind of made in an essayistic mode. But that's under a blue sun, and I guess the title refers to they put a blue tint on a lot of the war footage and like desert scenes in that film to disguise the desert, like the palette of the Israeli desert. I guess is quite unique, so they put a blue tint on the lens or the image to make it look like Afghanistan or not like Israel, which is kind of interesting.
They put on the Afghanistan desert filter.
Yeah, exactly. And there's actually, they made the film with like the cooperation of the IDF, and there is a sequence where they are shooting with the cooperation of the military there, flyover sequences or like the jets going over top of them. So these sequences of the jets, I think, were used in the film as like, the inserts for a lot of the war sequences with, fighter planes and whatnot. So it's kind of interesting to see how they cooperated with Israel or how Israel cooperated with like a Hollywood production. Because I think actually Rambo 3, if I recall on the film, they say it was like one of, if not the most expensive film ever made at that point. So it had a huge budget, just all these interesting kind of facets to the film. And it's kind of just deconstructing like how images, they have an inherently political value, regardless of what we think we're watching sometimes.
Yeah, especially on that scale, the generally imperialistic quality of 80s action cinema.
Yes, exactly. That's also has like a huge thematic weight in the film. It's just kind of like the imperialistic and military kind of aspects of the film.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So, Under a Blue Sun, Daniel Mann. I'll make a gratuitous mention here, since this movie is Rambo focused, of a Rambo adjacent movie. Did you ever see, like, this would have been like 15 years ago, this movie called Flooding with Love for the Kid?
I haven't.
It came out 15 years ago. It's a one-man movie. I don't, it might have even been adapted from an actual one-man show that adapts the original Rambo novel.
Oh, yeah.
And it's completely performed in the guy's apartment. I don't know. I reviewed it when it came out like 15 years ago.
Oh,
I keep hoping
wow.
someone like it'll resurface at some point, like at Spectacle or something. It might have already. Sorry, Spectacle, if you've already. But I don't know. It comes to mind because it's just this funny thing of taking this whole the whole Rambo thing and just like pressurizing it and channeling it through just one person, and it becomes this like
Yeah.
weirdly affecting like one man melodrama.
Rambo is a rich text. Who would have
Yeah,
thought?
that's right. Yeah, indeed. Well, let's see. So another movie you mentioned that I was pretty intrigued by, just because I don't know, I guess anything to do with Ukraine right now, whether it's like documentary or fiction, I'm always kind of curious about. And this one, it's called Grey Bees.
Yes, it's called Grey Bees. It's a Ukrainian fiction film. The filmmaker's name, I think, is Dmytro Mosiev. I think he's made a couple of films, but I've never seen anything by him before. This is a very well-made movie. It's like one of the more, if not the most accomplished film in the Tiger competition this year. Like had a seriousness and like a weight to it that other films, you know, as good as like Under a Blue Sun is, it, for whatever reason, doesn't have like this kind of gravity to it that this film does, because it is a like kind of a dour war film. So in some sense, it's very like festival art house oriented. So in that vein, I think it works quite well for what it is. It's set in Donbass in the gray zone, which is like a an areas on the border of Russia and Ukraine that are not ruled by one country or the other. So it follows two older elderly guys who are like the last people that are still in their village, who haven't fled or are still alive in their village, and they live next door to each other, but they kind of go back and forth between each other's houses each day. And one of them is Russian, one of them is Ukrainian. They kind of rely on each other just for company or cooking or just helping out. One is a beekeeper, which is where half of the name comes from, gray bees. It's like kind of a contrast in like personalities. They disagree on most everything, whether it's, you know, food or the actual politics of the war or, you know, just everyday activities. So there's kind of some fun bickering back and forth, even though it is like a very serious film. It's actually quite humorous at times, darkly funny, just the way they communicate and kind of snipe and bicker at each other back and forth. And it's shot in that quite typical art house static camera, no score, quite atmospheric sound mix, and you know, lit by a lot of candles and oil lamps. So in a sense, it reminded me of kind of like a Bélatar film, not quite as bravura as that or whatever, but it's a similar tone as something like that. And they do come in contact. Like, there's not a huge plot. A couple times here and there, soldiers show up from either side of the border, and they kind of have conversations with them, or just that's how they kind of keep abreast of the situation. And one in particular ends up being kind of a recurring visitor. But yeah, it's quite a, I don't know, illuminating just of the conditions and the situation. I mean, I think it's a fictionalized story, but I'm sure many people are actually living this way. So it's pretty interesting. And I do think it'll hopefully travel and be seen by more people, because I think it is, like I said, very well made.
No, I'm very curious about portraying these encounters and this holding pattern of this area.
Yeah, for sure.
How are the soldiers from each side portrayed when they do appear?
Well, there's not really any, other than one part, there's not really much violence to speak of. So when they do show up, it's very mostly casual. They talk to them, they kind of get updates. And sometimes, in some sense, it looks like sometimes the soldiers are checking on them. And yeah, one Ukrainian soldier, I believe, is the kind of recurring one. He becomes kind of friendly with one of the guys. So it continues to come back over and over. So yeah, it's kind of an interesting film in the sense that it doesn't necessarily demonize anyone. There's no like real villains, even though you know what the villain, everything's like unseen. All the violence is unseen, all the war is unseen. It's just kind of like these two guys living in the shadow of this like catastrophic event, basically. It's sort of tonally also like, do you remember that film The Load? Ognjen Galvanic. Yeah, I mean, that was a film set during like 1999, like the NATO bombings, but it had a similar, also similar tone, but like also in the sense that like you don't see what the kind of horrific backdrop is just, it's just that, just the backdrop, and you don't really see the specifics, but you know what's going on, kind of thing. So that it kind of has that similar feel to it in some sequences.
So yeah, Gray Bees, Dmytro Moiseyev. Also curious about Swimming Home. I mean, I guess that one also has like a couple of name actors.
Yeah, it has some stars in it. That seems like the one that's like going to be a real easy play in the US. It stars Christopher Abbott and Mackenzie Davis, but also Ariane Lebed, Greek actress who's great in this film. She plays a mysterious kind of outsider that infiltrates Christopher Abbott and Mackenzie Davis's family. So she just, the Ariane Lebed character, one day just is lying naked in their pool when they come home. And she's sticks around and kind of slowly seduces both like physically and just like mentally various people in the household, including the couple's daughter, who becomes like pals with her. You don't know what her motivations are or whatnot, and it has a kind of like a, I mean, there's definitely thriller elements, but it has kind of almost like a body horror type aspects by the end, which, you know, don't work as well as some of the other stuff. But there is it is based on a book, I guess, which I have not read, so I think a lot of the, you know, the arc of the film is kind of beholden to the book, which maybe accounts for some of the kind of directions it goes by the end.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very, it's a fascinating movie. It has like a real like interesting atonal score to it. It's in that vein of like not home invasion, but just like outsider figure films of the people infiltrating people's homes, like a Teorema or you know.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, especially since with Teorema in common, just the fact that she sounds like she kind of ensorcels everyone.
Yes, exactly. It also gets very abstract, like the plot becomes a little opaque by the end, and the kind of Christopher Abbott character is a alcoholic poet who is like openly unfaithful to his wife, who knows about his infidelity, but they also have separate lives that they lead, and it kind of gets into like this, like I said, like a sort of a body horror type narrative by the end, that all these different like kind of stranger aspects seep their way in, which starts as a simple setup and kind of becomes more and more kind of opaque by the end. So yeah, so some of the stuff by the end didn't totally land for me, but I it's very like entertaining, and I think it is a debut film as well, so I think it's quite well done for a first film.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize that.
I think it's a British director.
Yeah, Justin Anderson. Yeah.
It's got a, obviously an international cast, but yeah, the Arion Lebed character is great. She's like, I don't know if you've seen her in any other movie, she has like a physicality to her that's like very unique. And in this movie, she's frequently using her body in interesting ways. So it's worth it for her performance, if nothing else.
I feel like I'm playing like movie association, but I did just rewatch Sexy Beast.
All right.
But a pool is central. Basically, kind of standard. I mean, it's like someone saw the limey and like they wanted to do like a straight and like, I don't know, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and they wanted to do
Yeah.
get him, to do something, and he had done cool music videos, Jonathan Glazer. But I'd sort of forgotten that there's this insane like fever dream aspect of like this bunny demon.
Right.
This like rabbit demon. I don't know. I guess I just sort of suppressed that.
It's been a while since I've seen that. I don't remember that.
But yeah, just taking something pretty conventional, but throwing in this rabbit demon was kind of interesting. So swimming home, and then I'll stick with Rotterdam just for one second more because I think people might be curious about the top Tiger Award winner. I don't know if you happen to catch Ray.
Oh, right, yes. I did watch it. It's a 3 hour long Japanese film. It's very moody and atmospheric, I guess, but it kind of bites off more than it can chew. And I didn't really go with it by the end. So I will say it was the first movie I saw when I landed, and I like went from the airport right there to watch a 3 hour film. But it did win the top prize, which I was sort of surprised about.
Yeah, that, and then I don't know, there was one called Kiss Wagon that was also like a really long movie, it sounded like.
I only sampled that. It's a 3 hour animated film. Probably not totally for me. I watched like 30 minutes of it or so, because they are nice enough to give a online platform to critics, but it's geo-blocked to the Netherlands, so you kind of have to watch stuff while you're there. But it helps as far as like sampling films you might not otherwise want to watch or might not be predisposed for.
Yeah, no, that's always really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were complaining on the Sundance podcasts about how it starts late.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Rotterdam one is like it goes all the way through, which is cool. So you can kind of in the early days when it's not as packed, you can kind of sample stuff or watch things. So yeah, I watched a number of things that I ended up liking in that way. And the program is gigantic, like it's so big at Rotterdam, so it's hard to see everything you want.
Yeah, it is pretty big, yeah. Well, we can close the book on Rotterdam 24. Unless there's any other last notes or.
No, other than to say I did think this year was better overall, and especially the Tiger competition. I found like everything we talked about, I think, was Tiger comp, except for Dream Team, I guess, was the only thing not in competition. But otherwise, those are all in there, and so I thought it was pretty strong. Whereas last year, I think I really only found like one or two things that I enjoyed. It's the fourth year under the new director of the festival, so after the 2 years online, she has now a couple years under her belt now. So I think it's they had a turnover in a lot of their programming, which was unfortunate. But I think she's kind of established a new approach, and it started to come into its own, I think, finally. The new team has also got a lot of good people on, and I think after the dust settled, I think it's starting to seem like its own thing again. And there's been a more an increase in like American films and English language films, I think, in the last few years, which is kind of cool to see. Like it's not only kind of like international art cinema. You can see stuff like Dream Team and Swimming Home and things like that, like English language films, which is not always the case.
No, that's cool. I think interesting things happen when you put all the movies together as opposed to balkanizing.
Yeah, I will say their competition too does have like stuff like Under a Blue Sun. Like you don't see a lot of essay films or documentaries in like competitions at major festivals. So
Yeah.
it is a quite an eclectic and animated films for that matter. There are two animated films in competition. So it is very eclectic. It's not just all like Grey Bees type films, which is kind of like what you feel like when you're a lot of festivals, just like the real kind of dour art films. So in that way, it is very even the stuff that doesn't land is a very you're kind of appreciate the breadth of styles and approaches.
Well, I will get there someday. So that brings us to something entirely different. A movie that was like an original seed for when we were talking about doing a podcast, I think in December, I want to say.
Yeah.
And it's sort of an interesting case, for me, because like it's a movie that kind of had a low profile. I mean, as far as it could, given all the people that are in it and studio it's with. And I thought, oh, this is kind of a strategy in some way. But then, yeah, it stayed sort of weirdly under radar coming out just at the end of the year. And that is The Iron Claw.
I hit you up to talk about this film for a couple of reasons. Well, one, I enjoyed the film, but the main draw, at least for me, is that it's a film about pro wrestling, and I'm a lifelong pro wrestling fan from like 12 years old until this very moment, so this very day. So it's very rare to see like a serious wrestling film. The last one I can think of is The Wrestler, and that movie was good too, but kind of focused on well, one was a fictional character, but by and large focused on like Mickey Rourke's the personal life more than the professional life. And it was like about a retired wrestler trying to hang on. This movie is about a family, the Von Erichs, a family of wrestlers who maybe aren't as well known as some of the big wrestling families that like the Harts or the Rhodes, Dusty Rhodes or the Flairs, people like this, multi-generation families of wrestlers. But they are one of the most important families in wrestling. The father, Fritz Von Erich, ran a wrestling promotion in the Dallas area called World Class Championship Wrestling, which was around in the 60s and 70s, became really big in the 80s when his sons became wrestlers. And he retired around the same time. Well, he had six boys altogether. Five wrestled in some capacity. The youngest one died very early, 6 years old, I think. But the movie deals with this very tragic story about how there was kind of a cycle of mental illness and addiction and just bad luck that resulted in many deaths and suicides by most people in the family. So it's quite a tragic film, actually, and something that in some sense is tailor-made to like be a movie, but is also kind of like almost unbelievable that this stuff could happen. So I've watched a number of documentaries on this in the past and know quite a bit about it. But so I was interested to see a movie made about it, but then also a movie made by Sean Durkin, who
Right.
had made Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and also The Nest, which he's only made two movies in like 12 years, so it's kind of like surprising to see him do this as his third film.
Really, his third feature. I thought somehow he had made another one. Yeah, geez. I think I mix him up with another guy somehow.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene in a while, but I feel like that movie's slightly maybe overrated. But The Nest, I remember actually liking and thinking it was like unfairly trashed. So, any case, he's sort of an interesting filmmaker, but apparently, he's a huge wrestling fan. So when I saw the Q&A when I saw this film back in like November, he talked about his like fandom. So he's a good choice, I guess. And I'm assuming you don't know much about wrestling or don't about this family at the very least,
How
right,
dare
Nick?
you? How dare you, sir?
No, you might. You can tell me.
No, it's true. I don't really. I've absorbed a certain amount. It sort of was inevitable growing up in the 80s.
Yeah.
I knew of this story, but just actually seeing it dramatized,
Yeah.
it's kind of incredible because it already has this almost mythic quality. That's an overused word, but like when you have a family with like six sons and then they're each struck down by the heavens in different ways, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, people said that the family's cursed, this and that. Who knows? I guess the main focus of the film, at least the fictionalization of the story, is around, I think, the second oldest son, Kevin Von Erich, who's played in the film by Zac Efron. I had some issues with the film, just like as a wrestling fan, and about like the biographical aspects and the kind of timeline, chronology, and things like that. But one of them is, yeah, Kevin Von Erich, the Zac Efron character, is portrayed in the film kind of as like the star of the family, when in reality, two of the other brothers, at the very least, were either bigger stars or like primed to be bigger stars. So it's kind of focused on him because he's the last living brother, which makes sense. But as a wrestling fan, you kind of know that he's not necessarily the main attraction. Whereas the oldest brother, who died first, other than the real young one, His name's David Von Erich. He was kind of like the one prime to be the champion at the time. It was like in the 80s, wrestling was like territories. It wasn't there was no national cable to broadcast. So all these wrestling promotions had their own TV locally. So like WCCW in Texas had local TV, and then there was like some syndication, I think, around the US. But by and large, it all kind of happened in Texas. And the oldest brother, again, David, played by Harris Dickinson, was kind of primed to be the next champion after Ric Flair in like 82, 83. And at one point, he travels on this tour to Japan and dies in his hotel room, like alone. It's since been said that it was a like an infection in his stomach that killed him, like at random. But there's also, considering what's happened afterward, suicide theories and whatnot. But this just kind of started a cycle of like addiction and suicide in his family, which carried on to one of the younger brothers, Mike Von Erich, and then also another son that's actually not depicted in the film, Chris Von Erich, which we can talk about that omission too, which is kind of interesting.
Oh yeah, I think I'd heard chatter about that.
There's three main brothers, basically, the ones that you see in the film. And then there was like a fourth one who was a little bit younger, who, when this older brother David died, they brought him in as like a replacement because they like, we need him, they were hugely popular in Texas. So they brought in this other brother to replace him. And he was not as muscular, as big. He wasn't as athletic, but he was a brother. So they brought him in and he was fine, but he at one point got hurt. He like hurt his shoulder. Something happened and he got an infection, got a staph infection, and then went into toxic shock syndrome. He recovered, but he had like severe cognitive problems. Like you see in the film, he doesn't talk quite right. And if you see footage of him after this happened, like something's not quite right. Continued to, which is not depicted in the film, but he continued to actually wrestle for a little bit and then couldn't kind of like shoulder the burden of living up to his older brother who had passed away and then ended up killing himself. So that was kind of like the second major death. And it ended up continuing down the line until Kerry Von Erich did the same thing, who's like was the biggest star and like wrestled in the WWE for a bit. In the film, he, if you don't know these characters, he's the one who got in a motorcycle accident and lost his foot and continued to wrestle for like many years without a foot.
Oh, wow.
He had like a prosthetic and nobody, it was kept a secret. And he wrestled for a long time, but it also ate away at him where he, yeah, ended up also dying in the same way as many of his other brothers. So yeah, it was like a kind of a tragic, just like cycle that has been broken by Kevin Von Erich, the Zac Efron character, who is still alive and living in Hawaii with his sons, who are also wrestlers now. So in some sense, it has at least like some bright spot. But yeah, I enjoyed the film, and it is my only issues actually with the film are kind of those narrative things that are condensed. Like they show Kerry Von Erich's foot injury happening the same night that he ended up winning the world title, which technically was like 2 years later. It's not a big deal, but to me, when I was watching the film, I was almost like, I wonder if someone who doesn't know about what happens is like thinking this is like way too convenient, or like this, how could this ever happen? Like the same night, which it didn't happen the same night, but. And I think that's one of the reasons they cut out the very youngest brother who also ended up killing himself, because I think it was just too many things. Like people wouldn't go with that much tragedy, that much. You got to suspend your disbelief because it is kind of stranger than fiction in a lot of ways. So
Yeah, it would have seemed of a piece if that was if that brother was included. I
yeah.
mean, it's just this drumbeat of tragedy, but also tragedy that also just feels like they're getting eaten up by this like entertainment machine somehow.
Yeah, and in the 80s there was, a lot of drug use in wrestling. These guys were, on, steroids among other things, but actual like, narcotics type drugs. So there was, that abuse going on as well with their already kind of fragile mental states and, their kind of domineering rule of their father, who's played by Holt McCallany, who's quite good in the film, actually. That's where the name the Iron Claw comes from. His like finishing move, the dad's, was this kind of grab the guy's whole head with his hands and like squeeze the temples. So it's a very old school, like mid-century wrestling move. Yeah, the good stuff in the film is like, to me, it really captures a like an era of wrestling. Like the production design is incredible. Like the Sportatorium where a lot of these matches happen, they kind of recreated that in the film, which is no longer around. By the mid-80s, WWF expanded and bought a lot of these small territories, including WCCW. So there's kind of a mythical quality to that arena specifically. So I thought Durkin did a good job kind of like recreating that. And a lot of like just the look of everyone in the film is incredible too. Like Zac Efron, like they look amazing. They're all jacked. And his character is actually not quite as ripped in real life as in the movie, but since he's a central character, they make him kind of like the buffest one of all of them.
Yeah, I thought his character was interesting too.
Yeah, the camaraderie among the brothers is kind of like the film, and that's like,
Yeah.
that's why people are calling it like a male weepy in some ways. So it is kind of a male melodrama, which is kind of what wrestling is when you get down to it. So
Right. That's what I responded to probably the most was that camaraderie between the brothers. And I don't know, it was a real genuine quality to it. And that's something that it just doesn't really come across, even in movies that, don't have some like larger backstory going on. I
yeah.
thought it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I will say if people saw this movie, don't know about it, but are interested, I'd recommend two documentaries. There's one called The Triumph and Tragedy of WCCW, which is like about not just the family, but about the entire promotion. And there was an episode of a series called Dark Side of the Ring, which focuses on like tragic stories in wrestling, which there are plenty. There's one called The Last of the Von Erichs, which is like a shorter, 45-minute version of the events that took the lives of all these brothers.
Yeah. And I hate to bring this in, but I also have to say that like the whole wrestling culture just of kind of showmanship, it's hard to escape that that kind of defines politics right now.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, it's there's more of a unfortunate crossover between these kind of things and reality TV and a lot of things.
Right.
Like there's a saying in wrestling, like everything is wrestling. Like everything in culture is actually wrestling when you get down to it. So there's good and bad aspects to that. Personally, I do believe it is a art form in and of itself. So there is something to be said for all aspects of it, because it is a performance and a athletic contest and everything else, and a feat of TV and writing and lots of things going on. Yeah, so I mean, overall, I did enjoy the film. The worst part of it, honestly, is the guy they cast to play Ric Flair, who has like one scene, but he's awful. I don't know if you remember this part, but like he does like a promo or whatever, and he's just like doing the Ric Flair thing, but like he's awful at it. And why would you pick someone who can't even like impersonate him well? So that was the worst part of the movie. But everyone else was extremely well cast.
Yeah, just curious what's like the next big thing coming up in terms of like wrestling, or at least in what you'll be looking forward to.
Well, there is WrestleMania, which is just about a month and a half away, which is the big WWE event every year, which it looks like the Rock is coming back for that. So that is a crossover cinema and a wrestling thing nowadays. He hasn't wrestled in like 10 years, so he's back.
That's crazy.
He recently became a board member of the WWE, so which is also embroiled in a gigantic scandal, like which happens every like 10 years with them. But in any case, yeah, The Rock is coming back to fight his cousin Roman Reigns, who has been the champion for many years. So they are fighting for kind of like in their storyline, it's the bloodline because they're all Samoan. So they're fighting for who's the head of the table is what they call it, but the top of the heap as far as Samoan wrestlers go. Because there are another of the huge families in wrestling, like the Anoa'i family, which is like there's like dozens of Samoan wrestlers that are all related to The Rock in one way or the other.
Wow. I did see that because that was reported widely, him becoming part of the board. I didn't re realize that he'd also be like getting in the ring.
Yeah, the storyline with Roman Reigns has kind of been building where he's like saying he's the greatest Samoan wrestler ever. And so it was kind of inevitable that The Rock would come back. It was just kind of like, when is he going to do it? And hopefully he does it before he's too old, because he's, in his 50s now. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, to be continued.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up there with the Iron Claw. I can't say we don't have range.
Exactly. This is what you bring me on here for.
That's right. No, I love it.
Art, cinema, and wrestling.
Jordan, thank you for taking us through many universes on this episode.
I do what I can.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.